Hello, everyone. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles. This is your host, Valerie. I am so excited to have a friend and a colleague here with me today. Hello and welcome, Brian Dilley. How are you?
Hi, Valerie. I'm great. And I'm just so glad to have this opportunity to talk to you. I've listened to your podcast many times and I'm really honored at the invitation.
So I want to give you all a little bit of a backstory on who Brian is and why I am so excited to have him here. First of all, Brian comes to us. I know him because he and his beautiful wife graduated from one of my Latter-day Struggles growth and processing groups. And you probably don't know this, Brian, but I will tell you as I'm telling everybody else, Brian is one of those individuals who is so kind and so smart that every once in a while we would be talking in the group, I would literally actually ask him to say that one more time because I would want to take notes on what he said. Brian comes to us as an expert in something that I think is going to be really interesting and really profound for us to talk about. And what I want to do, Brian, as we kick this off, is tell us why I invited you here.
Yay. I was wondering that myself, actually. No. When BYU decided to use Elder Holland's Musket Fire talk as part of their Foundations for Student Success program, I was concerned as a friend of BYU. That talk is problematic for a few reasons. And one of the reasons is because it will draw increased scrutiny by accreditors because of the things that were in that talk. If BYU puts it forward in their foundations course as a sort of exemplar of the BYU way, I shared a letter with the school officials. I'm sure they got a lot of emails on that, so it probably got buried in their inbox. But I shared it from a sort of accreditation perspective, the problematic nature of that. And then I shared that with Nathan, who shared it with Valerie, and she said, hey, let's talk about this.
Okay. So he just gave a little bit of a broad overview of what we are going to be discussing today. He is someone who, from the professional side, is involved in the accreditation process of universities and colleges here in the United States of America. And so he comes to us with a very special and unique perspective. Also, Brian comes to us, I believe, with another kind of credential that makes what you're going to share with us really valuable, Brian. You really, really love BYU. You're like me. We went to BYU. We have a lot of affection for this university. And so we come to this conversation not to be critical, but we come to this conversation because we really care about our alma mater. We both were concerned about the news that just broke a couple of weeks ago. So before we jump in deeper to these waters, let's go ahead and orient this audience about this Tribune article, because let's not make the mistake in assuming that everybody knows what we're talking about. Brian, would you give us just a bit of an overview about the story that broke in the Tribune, connecting BYU with Elder Holland's talk that has sort of been colloquially called the Musket Fire talk and accreditation? So let's just give a big overview of what the Tribune had to say and why we're kind of delving into this topic today.
Sure. And let me back up a second, because I realized you were inviting me to establish my BYU credentials, which I didn't. So yes, my parents went to BYU. I met Jen there, my wife. Her parents went there. Her grandparents went there. Her great-grandparents went there. And all four of our kids have either graduated from BYU or are currently attending. And so all of our kids. So basically, we bleed blue in the BYU house. We're longtime BYU people. And so that is, as you said, where we're coming from, a place of love and concern, not a sort of, you know, vitriol. So yes, this article is what drew our attention in the Tribune, that, you know, the speech that was given by Elder Holland was troubling when it was given for reasons that we'll talk about. But, you know, one-off speeches happen all the time, you know, where you just sort of, you move on. But once the article indicated that BYU was integrating that speech into their Foundations for Success course, that means that we're not moving on. We're in fact ensconcing that speech in a fairly privileged place, and it reopens all of the issues that speech brought up. So that's I think why we're talking now. But
yeah. Thank you. Yes, yes. Thank you for that concise sort of overview. And this just broke. I think the story happened. It was a busy weekend for the church because this happened a day or two before the Instagram post on women's issues happened. So it was a couple of, there was a lot going on there. And yet at the same time, I wanted to circle back and talk about this because of my affection for this university. And also because I think it's a big deal. It also really taps into what is currently going on in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at large with civil rights issues and how BYU is sometimes the organ that communicates values and is also training that young generation of college students. And so there's a lot going on here that we want to spend our time talking about. So what I want to do right now is I'm going to offer you all a little bit of an overview of what Brian and I are going to cover in the next, in this episode and in the next episode. We are going to spend some time talking specifically about the importance and the significance of including this musket fire talk, which is formally called the second half of the second century of Brigham Young University. It was given by Jeffrey R. Holland on August 23rd, 2021 to all university faculty. As I suspect kind of, I dare say I'm not an academic professor, but I wonder if maybe at the beginning of every year, there's probably a gathering of faculty and staff to kind of kick the year off by some of the Board of Trustees. Is that correct? Is that kind of the context of that, Brian?
That is correct. That's standard practice at colleges and universities is to have a convening. It's called a convocation where the faculty, the staff get together and it sort of sets the tone for that academic year. It's often a sort of rah-rah speech to get excited about before the students show up. But also it's a time for the college to talk about its priorities for that year and anything major going on. You know, if there's a major initiative or if there's accreditation visit coming up, everyone needs to know about that. You know, so these convocation meetings are a way to set the tone for that current year.
Wow. And so an interesting time to introduce this very significant and, well, I think it brought up a lot of emotions in a lot of the faculty. And the other thing that I find fascinating about that is that it definitely expanded beyond its own initial audience almost as soon as it was offered. It was that big of a deal. So we're going to spend some time talking about the significance of some of the things that were mentioned there from a couple of different perspectives. Another thing that we're going to do is we're going to talk about how the addition of this talk in the curriculum of the freshman experience class is significant. And we're going to define what the freshman experience class even is for those of you who are not in higher education like myself. And then we're going to talk about the significance that's even larger that is being communicated by adding this into the curriculum, which is being taught to our children, and how this possibly is putting BYU in harm's way from a credentialing perspective. So there are multiple layers, waves of concern that Brian and I want to walk through. And then I have asked Brian if he would actually read the letter of concern that he wrote to the executives at Brigham Young University as a BYU fan, an alumni, and as someone who is in fact, a professional credentialing board member. Okay, that will kick that. That kind of sets us up for the next, well, for the rest of this episode and the next episode. Brian, let's go ahead and just get started getting to know you a tiny little bit better, because I think your story is actually quite interesting. In our conversations and in planning this time together, you shared with me that you have a long time interest in Brigham Young University, but also you have an understanding from back when you were a student yourself in the 80s and 90s in being involved in issues of this nature. So can you just sort of give us a sense of how you don't come to this game new?
Yes, I was at BYU at a great time to be there in the late 80s and early 90s. There was a lot of talk, a lot of excitement going on. And really it was pivotal, influential for me, because I grew up in a small Idaho town where the general sense was that learning things was dangerous and that, you know, you didn't want to think things through a little too hard because that might drive you out of the church. And I chafed at that. I didn't like the idea of having boundaries and limits on your thought, because I thought the whole point of mortality is to learn and grow and develop. And that's what our doctrine and literature says. And so it was weird that the coach I grew up in was like, no, that's all dangerous. And so then when I went to BYU, I really had an opportunity to really explore the idea of seeking learning by study and faith. And BYU really showed me how to do that. And I've always been grateful for that. I took a couple classes from Hugh Nibley. I had a journalism class with the great Alf Pratt, who was a foundational person there at BYU. I studied under Donnelly Bowen, who is the one who encouraged me to think about a career in academia, which I had not even considered until she brought that up. And so I'm always grateful for her saying, you know, have you thought about being a college professor? And I said, no. And she said, well, you should. I think you'd be good at it. And if she hadn't said that, I'd have a completely different life. So I'm grateful for her. I took one class from Omar Cater that, even though I only had one class from him, it was a very sort of deep lesson and learning. And it helped me think of the world in different ways. My mentor there was Valerie Hudson, who has written a lot on women's issues in the world and in the church. She showed me a path to foreign policy analysis, which is what I ended up doing my graduate work in. While there, I was active in the student clubs, and so I joined the College Democrats. I was the vice president of the College Democrats, and the big joke there is there were three of us, and I lost the election, and so I was the vice president. I wrote opinion pieces for the Daily Universe because at the time I was thinking I might be an editorialist, and there was a conservative newspaper that was a student-run newspaper that I and the leader of that paper had lots of conversations about the need for a space to have reasoned discourse and respectful dialogue among differences. And he and I agreed that was so important. And so he felt strong enough about it. He started a newspaper called The Conservative Edge, and he gave a full page to me. And so if you opened up the newspaper, the middle, the centerfold was the words from the left, which was my contribution, and then the words from the right, which was his contribution. And we would have debates about a given issue on each publication that they had. And so we really tried to model this notion of a safe space to explore ideas. And then at the very end of my time there as a senior, I was a writer for the Student Review, which was another off-campus newspaper that was primarily satire, but also because it was off campus, we could explore things that the campus paper couldn't explore. And my editor at the time was Joanna Brooks, who I learned a lot from, and she's gone on and done amazing things, particularly in the space of LDS feminist issues. You might recognize her name from that. But she was a great editor to work for. And we had, again, most of it was satire, but we had some issues because the Gulf War was breaking out right at that time. And so we had the war issue where we really challenged some of the more jingoist thoughts at the time. And then we had another issue that we were called the gay issue because we talked about LGBT issues and kind of explored that space of what does it mean to be LGBT and LDS. And we got a lot of pushback on that. In fact, and I appreciate Joanna because she sort of protected me because my articles often ruffled some feathers. And I remember there was a conversation where the person who was in charge of advertising, because it was a private paper, they needed advertising to stay afloat, he said, can you please tell Brian to stop writing these articles? Because every time he does, we lose an advertiser. And so she was like, no, he's doing what he needs to do. And so it was a great sort of environment that was intellectually fulfilling, spiritually fulfilling. And that's one reason I just loved my BYU experience. And I so appreciate that my own kids have had that experience and want that ability to have that kind of learning by study and faith to be available to students at BYU now.
So let's just spend a few minutes talking about this concept of academic freedom, Brian, because what you're describing about your own history seems like, and maybe I'm wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you enjoyed a fair degree of academic freedom in your own university education at BYU in the 80s and 90s. Is that fair to say?
I think it is fair to say. Rex Lee was the president, and it was a good environment. There was tension, and that's one point I want to make today, is that there's always been tension at BYU on this issue.
So will you define what academic freedom is for those of us who are, maybe went to college, but may not understand it from the side of the career standpoint? Because I think this is a relevant topic for our larger conversation today. What is academic freedom?
So academic freedom is when a researcher, a scholar at a university or college has the freedom to explore their discipline, to research and go where the facts lead, go where the theories are leading them, and not have to worry about how that research will be received, particularly from their own university. Because the concern, if we go back in the history and the case law, 100 years ago, there were several instances where a professor would publish something. Maybe it was an article on evolution, and the trustees of the college thought evolution was, like the devil's playground. And so they would then fire that professor for publishing an article on evolution. And so that is what that concern was there for. Political issues, socialists at universities back east, or maybe a social justice article in a university in the South, in a segregationist South. And so there's been a norm developed and some case law surrounding it that protects professors to be able to explore within their discipline and be able to speak from their expertise, sort of regardless of how that's received. Now, there are some limits on that. You should only be doing it within your expertise. So if a chemistry professor is talking about women's rights, that might be protected under the First Amendment, just as citizens, but there's no academic freedom protection for that person. But if a biologist is talking about evolution, that is sort of within their domain. And so it doesn't mean that, you're not the boss of me. I'm a professor. I can do whatever I want. That's not what academic freedom is. And I've had arguments with our own faculty senate, because there are some people who think that academic freedom is a license to do whatever they want to do. And that's not what academic freedom is. But at its core, it's the ability of a professor within their discipline to speak about controversies in their discipline without fear of retribution by the institution.
Wow, what a beautiful statement. Thank you that you just defined that really well. And I feel like I already learned so much from you. Let me do this. I want to review what I think I heard, or at least what I'm taking in, is what you're describing in academic freedom, basically saying that we, inside of one's own discipline, one need not begin with a conclusion that something has to be a certain way to keep the university at large comfortable, meaning that the scientific method is in fact honored, and that inside of one's own discipline, one is always seeking for larger and larger and growing truth, which by default means that we enter into a question open to different answers than what are already perhaps established socially or in that discipline itself. Is that fair to say, Brian?
It is. And that is sort of the ethic behind it, is because without that freedom, progress with a capital P is difficult to make, because people will self-censor the conclusion. They will not ask questions that might lead to answers that are uncomfortable. They might be tempted to cook their data so that a predetermined outcome is what they find. And so you're trying to remove those incentives to allow science with a capital S to move forward.
And that, of course, is what makes higher education so incredibly powerful and provocative and important to the growth of truth in society at large, is kind of my understanding. Would you say that's true?
Correct. And that is the justification for it, because, Faculty, they're already in a fairly privileged place, especially in universities that have a tenure system. You know, once you have that tenure, you know, I'm in Arizona, we don't have tenure because the state law prohibits it. But in places that do have tenure, once you have tenure, unless you murder somebody, you basically can't be fired. And so faculty already have a sort of privileged space. So it's important to recognize again that academic freedom is not a license to be an agent of chaos, but it is the mechanism by which we protect people who are doing controversial work so that knowledge can move forward.
Okay, Brian, I have a quick question to ask you to follow up on this, because we're kind of taking a lot of different ideas and we're going to weave them all together. That is the plan of today, because there's a lot of topics here. What you're describing is the importance of academic freedom. And where we're headed now in this conversation is there's a body of professionals that help universities maintain academic freedom. Will you share with us a little bit about your work as a peer reviewer for an accrediting agency? Because that is really relevant to this larger conversation. Take it away, Brian.
Thanks. So yes, I've been a peer reviewer for 10 years with a regional accrediting agency. BYU is accredited by the Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities, NCCU. That is not the agency I'm with, but these agencies have similar criteria for accreditation and similar concerns. And pretty much all of them, ensuring academic freedom is one of those concerns. So let me talk a bit about accreditation and what it is and why it's important. So a school that is accredited means that their credits are transferable across institutions. It's a sort of a Better Business stamp of approval kind of thing on the college. And so I had a friend who went to law school from a non-accredited law school. Huge gamble, because what ended up happening is that his degree was not really looked at very well because it was not an accredited institution. So if you're accredited, that means your credits transfer. It means your degree is taken seriously. If you're moving on to graduate school, they accept the transcript for that. I mean, employers want an accredited university to be where your degree is from. If you are not accredited, that means you are not eligible for federal financial aid or veterans benefits. Because years ago, the Department of Education, when they were starting the GI Bill, they said, you know, we, the federal government, are spending a ton of money on higher ed. We should have some quality control. Maybe we should have some federal agency or congressional insight. And the industry, which often happens with interest groups, the industry said, no, 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 we will police ourselves. And the way we'll do that is we'll have this accreditation process. And so accreditation is a sort of a guarantee of a minimal level of competence on the part of the college. It's saying a grown-up college does the following things. And then there's a list. And that's what the criteria of accreditation are. And so every periodic, you know, some places it's every 7 years, some places it's every 10 years, they have to face scrutiny, and a team will go in with their little checklist and they look through, do you have evidence that you meet these criteria that a grown-up college should have? And again, the real risk is if you lose your accreditation, you are ineligible for federal financial aid and you're ineligible for veterans benefits. So nobody from GI Bill can attend the university, and no Pell Grants, no federal subsidized loans. All of that is attached to have you maintained your accreditation. So that's what accreditation is and why it matters. And a peer reviewer then is someone who doesn't work. They're not a full-time employee of the accrediting agency. They're someone who is at a peer college, a sister college, who, because of their professional background, they're able to go and look at the insides of a different college and compare it to that checklist.
Okay. Thank you so much. What a good overview to sort of set up why this matters, why this is all so important and relevant to the recent news about this address given by Jeffrey Holland in 2021 to the faculty. Okay. So let's see if we can kind of start linking some of these separate parts together. for the last part of our episode today. So why does accreditation body, why does this accrediting process matter? Why are we talking about this? Well, here's in a nutshell the reason why, and then we're going to go deeper into this. So in 2021, this talk was given, and it created almost an immediate firestorm, as we've already mentioned. We're going to go deeper into the content of this talk and a few things that were said in this talk that really, really matter. Brian mentioned a minute ago that was this talk a one-off and it sort of fell into the memory hole, as sometimes things like this do. It would have been problematic, but it would have sort of gone away. What we're dealing with right now is that beginning in January of 2024, not only has this talk not disappeared, but it has been added to the curriculum of every incoming freshman that attends Brigham Young University. It is required reading. And therefore, the contents of that address are incredibly important for us to understand, because in some ways they are a value statement of the way that the school, the university, it's what they're approving. It's what they're forwarding. It's talking about what matters to them. And Brian and I are going to sort of break down a few of the specifics of this talk, not only some of the content that is in there that is really relevant to our day and age and the civil rights issues of today, specifically queer issues, but in the very same talk, what Elder Holland actually proposes is a willingness to lose official accreditation status in order to stand by what they see as their correct ethic in the university. Okay, the last thing I want to talk about today as we end this episode is I think it'd be good to give a bit of an overview of this address itself, and then we're going to talk more in our next episode about the freshman experience class and why it's so significant that this talk is in the freshman experience class. So Brian, what would you say, anything you want to add as we move to that section of our conversation?
I think it'd be important at this point to identify what exactly in this speech raises an accreditation concern. Why on earth are we talking about accreditation? It's just a speech. And so let's take just a minute and tease that out. And it's because one of the criteria for accreditation is clearly academic freedom. But another one of the criteria that pretty much every institution, accrediting agency has, is the independence of the college from the Board of Trustees. Because there have been episodes in the past, particularly with private schools that are run for profit, where the controlling board gets into the weeds and manages the day-to-day operations of the college in a way that benefits the board. And that's problematic. And so that's not acceptable. That the board should have a clear distinction where the board sets general direction, they set tones, they're responsible to make sure the budget is good, and they hire and fire the president, but that's the extent of it. Then the day-to-day operation is by the president, and the president handles all the decisions of where exactly the money's going and handling the academic freedom and things like that. The board is not supposed to be involved in that. And so what's problematic about Holland's speech from an accreditation point of view is in the speech, he reminded the college that the board pays for everything, which is true. But he said, we make every decision right down to deciding to buy a pickup truck for the grounds crew, which again, the board does approve that, but the board's not supposed to be making those decisions. That's supposed to be made at an institutional level. And then the board does say yes or no, but it implies a more fine-grained control than is appropriate for a board.
Thank you so much, Brian. I think what I'm hearing you say is that, again, if we look at this from a purely professional standpoint, we have a university of higher learning that has certain minimum standards that it must hold up to continue to receive its accreditation. And you are someone who has expertise in this. You go and do these campus visits so that everyone is sort of keeping each other honest, right? And I'm sure your school has someone that comes in, again, from an outside sister school. And it's a beautiful, I love me a good check and balance. I mean, that's kind of what you're describing, right? It's a check and balance to make sure that these institutions of higher learning are using wisdom and ethics, and that there is a nice division of power, and that no one portion of the university, or that there's no body that comes in and overfunctions at the expense of what should be going on there, which is higher learning, right? Inquiry, the scientific method and things like that. And so what you're describing is that in this talk, what Holland actually described is in some ways a complete violation of the very minimum standard of what is expected of a university to sort of have a division of responsibility and a division of power, and that the trustees of the university are not over managing the university itself. Is that, did I capture that right, Brian?
Mostly. It is true. You know, all colleges have to do this. In fact, my own job, I'm the lead faculty for our accreditation efforts. And so it's my responsibility to get our college ready for our next visit, which is going to be next spring. So that's one reason these things are sort of top of mind for me, because I'm trying to get our own college ready for this. But it's not that Holland is saying they wanted total control, but the context of it is important. So let me read the quote here. He says, President Nelson chairs our board, holds our purse strings, and has the final yay or nay on every proposal we make, from a new research lab to more undergraduate study space to approving a new pickup truck for the physical facility staff. And by itself, that's fine, because that's true. The board just has the yay or the nay. They're not the ones making decisions. The problem is that it's in the context of the speech, which is saying that we don't appreciate the research and statements that are coming out of this college. And oh, by the way, we're paying for it. And so that it's not a complete control, but it's problematic. And it sort of invites additional scrutiny by an accreditor on this board, because it's hinting at a level of control that is not appropriate, because they don't appreciate the content of the research that's being done.
So let's stay with that, Brian. That's a good segue. So what you're basically saying is that this was mentioned importantly and significantly in the context of what was which was his addressing the portion about LGBTQ issues. So if I may, Brian, I want to just ask you to share with us why this is important, because we're talking about holding the purse strings, and then thereafter we're talking about an issue that starts to look to me like the limiting of academic freedom at this university. Can you spend a little bit of time opening or talking to us about that?
Sure, because what he's saying here is that the Board of Trustees doesn't appreciate some of the things that are coming out of BYU by the faculty. And then as an example of faculty going off the rails, he gives the LGBT issues. And we can talk later about why the specific content of the LGBT issues is problematic. But setting that aside, what he's doing is he's saying, if you, BYU faculty, are doing research that we in Salt Lake do not appreciate, that needs to stop. And oh, by the way, we're paying for things. That is the concern that brings up the accreditation issue, because it's saying academic freedom, fine and well, until it hits things that we find are important. And at that point, that's the boundary of academic freedom. You can't say things that look like they're critical of us or what we're doing. And that's where the whole musket fire came in. He wasn't talking about using muskets on LGBT people. He was complaining that the muskets are directed at Salt Lake. That's kind of the main point. And the LGBT is just the example that he gives. But the fact that he's making a fairly clear line here saying, we do not want to hear any more of this, you know, faculty doing things that run counter to what we would like them to do, because we're paying the bill. And then later on in the speech, he says, and, you know, this might cost us our accreditation, and we're okay with that. He didn't say that out loud. He kind of implied that. He's been the college president before. He knows what the accrediting criteria are now. And that really, for me, was probably the most troubling part of the speech, is when he expressed a willingness to threaten the accreditation of this school that I love. I think that's when my ears, and I don't really appreciate the examples he was giving, but when he said that sentence, my ears really popped up at that.
This is what he said exactly. If at a future time that mission means foregoing some professional affiliations and certifications, then so be it. There may come a day when the price we are asked to pay for such association is simply too high and too inconsistent with who we are. No one wants it to come to that, least of all me. But if it does, we will pursue our own destiny, a destiny that is not a matter of chance, but largely a matter of choice. Not a thing to be waited for, but a thing to be envisioned and achieved. Close quote.
That's an acknowledgement that what he's saying is right on the boundary of acceptable behavior by a board of trustees person. He understands that, he's acknowledging it, and he's saying, I'm willing to pay that price. And again, why we're having this conversation today is that that kind of speech, while as problematic as it is from an accrediting point of view, would probably be ignored by an accrediting team because, frankly, board members go rogue all the time. You know, we in our system here in Arizona, our board members were so egregiously bad at this that our accrediting agency had to come in and do a retreat and train them on how to be a proper board member because they were about to pull the accreditation of all of our colleges here in Maricopa County. I had a board member actually call me on the phone multiple times because I'm a political science person and he wanted to rant about some political thing. And, you know, he was trying to get me to agree with his political position, right? It's just that's like barging through a boundary that's supposed to be there between a board member and a faculty member. Holland knows this, and that's the concern. But again, that could be dismissed as a single one-off. But now that it's part of this new foundation, what the university is saying by including it in the new foundation is this is the BYU way. This is the way we do things, that we acknowledge the limit of academic freedom, and it's part of who we are. And so, again, there's always been a tension. We can talk later about the history of that tension. This doesn't necessarily mean they will lose their accreditation, but it invites scrutiny.
Yes, and that is going to be the topic of Friday's episode. And but before we close, I have a question that I have to ask you connected to this larger conversation. Hello, dear friends. As you probably know, I love creating the Latter-day Struggles podcast for you. I am so committed to providing you with frequent, honest, psychologically sound content to help you find faith, peace, confidence, and direction in your faith journey. However, I need your support. The content and the demands of this podcast have made it necessary for me to give up my previous work as a private practice therapist. As a way for you to show your support and gratitude for my work, I invite you to become a paid subscriber to this podcast, which will give you access to all of the Friday episodes. All Monday episodes will continue to be free of charge because I want you to be able to continue to know what we're exploring each week here on the podcast. So, for only $9.99 a month, you will not only continue to receive the content that has been so pivotal to your faith journey, but you can also help ensure that I can continue to serve this community. Your small cumulative contributions are already making such a difference. And also, you will be honoring the dedication, education, and commitment of a female Latter-day Saint professional who is brave enough to ask to be valued monetarily for her professional contribution to her community. Information on how to subscribe, information on how to become a monthly patron through my Patreon account, and also information on how to make a one-time donation through my professional Venmo account can all be found in my show notes at the bottom of each episode. So thank you so much for your ongoing support and trust. Now, back to the show. Brian, well, I'm circling back to something that you said several minutes ago that has piqued my interest. When someone starts research or starts talking about or opening up areas of inquiry in their own specialization, that's when we are infringing upon academic freedom. That's what I think I understood from earlier on. I'm looking at the LGBTQ issues on campus, and to me, it seems like it's perhaps both that plus a larger social issue that really is touching into not just academia, but also families and students and faculty and allyship and perhaps oppositional relationships and safety issues. And so can you spend just a moment as we close helping me and our audience better understand how this is all coming together as far as it being an an academic freedom question, but it seems as if it's a bigger question than that as well. And maybe this is just the whole confluence of all sorts of things, spiritual and theological and secular. It may be too big of a question for you to answer very concisely. So do your best with that one, my friend.
Well, and maybe this is just a teaser for a longer conversation in our subsequent, but it is important that, again, Holland was just using LGBT issues as an example of the real problem, which is faculty saying things that Salt Lake doesn't want to hear. And LGBT issues is just one example. Even said in the speech, you know, I've spent too much time on this. This is just a stand-in for a host of other issues. So that principle of don't offend us, that the speech came in, is the accreditation issue. But if we move beyond just that academic freedom issue and look at the actual content of the example that he gave, there is a potential for tremendous harm. That, you know, President or Elder Holland has done a several times in the past, and even in this speech, of showing a degree of understanding of the very difficult nature of being both LGBTQ and LDS. It is a hard space to navigate in. And he acknowledged in his speech, he said that too often the world has been unkind, in many instances, crushingly cruel to these, our brothers and sisters. So he's not a monster. He understands what the problem here is, but the intention of what he said and the public perception of what he said and the way some people will take it and weaponize it, the world is not just crushingly cruel to these LGBT brothers and sisters. The members of the church are crushingly cruel to members of brothers and sisters. And what Holland essentially said was, "We, if you are queer, we love you, we care about you, but keep your mouth shut," because all the examples he gave of problems were public representations. And so that is going to cause tremendous harm that we can talk about in more detail later. But that's in addition to the accreditation thing, is that it's communicating to students that here at BYU, we don't talk about this. So don't.
Yeah. And by extension, a whole cohort of students is left in harm's way.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then again, let's talk more about that, because the potential for harm is real.
Yes. We will pick that up in our next episode. You are such a fantastic conversation partner, Brian. I'm learning so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Delighted to talk to you.
Well, I'm so grateful for people like Brian. I find one of my spiritual gifts, I'm proud to say, is I like to surround myself with really smart people that can teach me things. And today is absolutely no exception. And for those of you who have benefited from this time that we've spent together, I just want to offer you my gratitude for your trust in the work that I do here on the Latter-day Struggles platform. And if there's anything else that I can do to help you in your faith expansion journey here in or around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, jump over to latterdaystruggles.com, where I am enrolling groups. I have a monthly Latter-day Night Live event where I go through a new topic of content each and every month, and they are complete with not only my time with you live, but also a workbook that is digital, that is yours. And also feel free to reach out to me if you'd like any one-on-one time with me on a limited basis or with my team. I'm so grateful to be with each and every one of you each week, and your ratings and reviews are incredibly important to help other people in the beginnings of their faith expansion journey feel like this is a safe place for their growth and development as spiritual beings. And last but not least, we are a proud member of the Dialogue Podcasting Network, and I'm really honored to be a part of this organization. They are the founding voice of progressive thought here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So please support them in any way that you can. And we will see you to follow up on this fascinating conversation in a couple of days. Take care, y'all. Bye-bye.
Dialogue Podcast Network.